Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 139, being recorded on the 10th of August, 2016. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest, Casey Watson. Now, before we let Casey tell us some cool things that he's been working on, we'll get to that in a minute. Let's just bring our listeners up to date on the latest and greatest in the Azure space. But even before that, Kale and Evan, I was a bit remiss in catching up with our Twitter updates over the last few weeks. So I finally got in there over the last couple of days. And boy, we had really had a lot of people kind of reaching out to us and giving us all sorts of comments and questions on our Twitter account. So just want to give a shout out to all our listeners who do use the Twitter feed. Thank you for all those. There were a couple of good ones. Kale, we got reminded about the website update. You know, you remembered that we had discussed revamping the website at some point.
Yep, yep.
And one of our listeners he remembered that we hadn't done that yet. So he asked us how that was going.
No, that's all good. That's good. We need pressure.
We need pressure, right? So I did mention that, you know, some of us are changing roles and we're kind of in the middle of things. But that's something that we need to get back on and get that ramped up. And it's been like, what, we've been running with the old website for almost 2.5 years. I think it's probably getting a little old.
Only in the IT world do we go, ah, oh, it's 2 years, you know, it still works, but let's change it anyway.
yes, this is the cloud world, you know, everything has to happen quickly. So that's one of the comments. And then I think, Evan, there was another comment. I think you and I went back on IM, and we kind of clarified that about using multiple storage accounts for resilience and availability sets. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, so I can't remember exactly when we had brought that up, but you know, we're talking about kind of building for high availability and optimizing that in Azure. And one of the things that I had made a comment about was, hey, if you have two VMs in the same availability set, if you put them in the same storage account, by definition, they're going to be on the same, you know, component in Azure storage, right? So the unit of scale that we use, they're going to be in that same unit. Now, so I had said, always put them in two different storage accounts. At that point, you're not guaranteed, at least today, right? This is a feature we're talking about for the future, but you're not guaranteed to end up on two different scale units, but you at least have a chance, right? And at that point, I mean, again, the odds of a single scale unit going down are pretty low, but if one does, and you kind of optimize to try and make sure you're not on the same scale unit, then you have a pretty good chance of only one machine being affected. And again, part of this is we have so many scale units that if you create two storage accounts, you know, one now and one 10 minutes later, the odds of them landing on the same exact stamp is pretty small.
Right. No, I'm glad that you were able to clarify that. And the Twitter user was very appreciative that we got back to them on that. There was another comment that was made about just about the audio quality on one of the episodes that we had maybe 3 or 4 episodes ago. The audio quality wasn't very good, and they said it's a lot better in the more recent episodes. And I was trying to think back as to why it was bad at that time. You know, we use a software called Audacity to mix to do the post production of our show. And I think what I did is I tried a new filter in Audacity to kind of level out the volume between. But each of us speak at different volumes, and you know, when I like to keep it more or less uniform. It looked like when I used one of those filters, it kind of distorted the sound a little bit. So I think I've stopped using that filter now, and it's probably a lot better. Okay, so enough of the Twitter updates. Let's get back to some Azure updates. And Kale, as usual, thanks a lot for putting some stuff in the show notes. Anything you want to start off with?
Definitely the one, and I don't know, because I wasn't here last week. Hopefully you didn't talk about this yet, but the N-Series preview is out there. So the GPU SKUs that we've talked about before on past podcast episodes is actually out there now, finally, in a preview form. And there's a blog post out there. There's actually a new site that got set up. People can go to publicly if they want to register some interest in this program from the preview. It's just gpu.azure.com. So you can go up there. It lists all our SKUs, which one you might be interested in. And the blog post kind of goes through like some of the things we've been thinking about for workloads, because there's basically like two big kind of buckets here. One around big scale compute, and then the other one is around rendering. So being able to do remote rendering with Autodesk and some of the different engineering softwares is a hotbed where people are looking at that one. The blog post is pretty good. It walks through what how many cores they have, what GPUs are in them, how many cards there are, all those different kind of nice features about that. And we've talked about this a bit in the past, but it's finally realized, and it's in the I think the preview, and it's on that blog post, is in South Central region, but they're looking to have that GA before the end of the year.
Nice. And just so that we get the mention the word blockchains.
I was just going to say that.
I got to ask, does this make it any easier to do some of the mining and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. So the mining stuff is something that's more public, you know, like public Ethereum or Bitcoin. Enterprises that are going to be looking to leverage blockchain technology won't have those same demands. Just like 2 seconds to geek out on this a second, but like basically what you're doing in the real world there for Bitcoin and public Ethereum is saying we have to control inflation, so we're going to use electricity and power to do that by forcing an algorithm that somebody has to run that uses a massive amount of electricity and compute to do something. The idea is not to do that, in an enterprise scenario.
Got it. Thank you. Well, now we got a blockchain in, so we can proceed.
The obligatory mention in whatever counts here.
I'm going to put a link out there, by the way. Just one more blockchain thing. We're setting up a public Yammer for people, because I noticed that you had mentioned, I think it was on Twitter, someone had asked about more information on blockchain stuff.
Right.
So we're going to start
for
opening up a channel there.
For developers, yeah, exactly. Yep. I'm glad you reminded me. Thank you. Okay, that's great. And then Evan is, I see a SQL thing here.
I was going to say, the SQL is Kale the blockchain, right? this is yet another bigger, beefier performance level for Azure SQL Database. So now we've got a what's called the P15, and this is 4,000 DTUs, and I'm spacing on what DTU stands for. But basically, this is an indication of basically a work unit in SQL. So the higher the DTUs, the more work units you get. It might be database transaction units, I think. But basically just bigger, stronger SQL Azure or Azure SQL databases.
You know, this one update that I kind of like in this list over here, and that's the application insights. You can now track an analytics query right in the dashboard. So, in the Azure portal, you have these dashboards you can set up, and you can share them with other people within your company. But the dashboards show you metrics of some of your services, and those metrics are typically the built-in metrics, the ones like CPU or memory or something like that. But if you have some specific application insights query that is important to you, maybe it's some very deep metric inside of your application that you want to surface as an item in the dashboard. There wasn't a way to do that, and now you can. So if you got some of those queries that are important to you, you can put them alongside these other built-in metrics and then have a nice view that shows a complete end-to-end picture of your application from the built-in metrics all the way to your custom metrics in your application. So I thought that was a cool thing.
Yeah, no, definitely.
What else? Go ahead.
I was gonna say. I mean, we got to talk about the fact that the new Gartner ratings came out, and now we're a leader in both IaaS, PaaS, and SaaS. And don't ask me why it's not SaaS, but in all three areas, right? And these are the three kind of core pieces of cloud. And it's great to see us. It's been a long road for some of these areas, but it's great to see us kind of leading the pack. Not necessarily at the top yet. We're shooting for that, but we're definitely in the leader group. Across all the different categories.
And I'm just going to mention it here only because it's somewhat related to the topic of discussion today that we're going to have with Casey in just a minute. But I think there were two cloud companies were out there, right, in that quadrant, AWS and Azure. I think those were the two that were up there. So they're kind of, I just want to mention that in all fairness that, you know, we weren't the only one that was in that leader quadrant. I think AWS was also there. So, yeah, I mean, it's good that we've caught up for the most part with them. We're in terms of maturity and services available, just the overall availability of the service, of all the services, etc. So that's a good thing. All right, and Kale, is there something else you want to pick up?
The last one here is interesting to me, and I'm sure our listeners, at least those who are doing some sort of development or DevOps type work. And basically, the Visual Studio Team Services team is, it looks like it's going to start publishing a monthly digest of kind of features, things that they've been working on, or new things that are being lit up in that service, because it's evolving pretty rapidly. And they have a list of some things up there in this first post. We'll put a link to that that walk through some new features that didn't exist there, and some of the integration with IDEs, as well as, you know, some interviews actually with the team. So you can take a look at that. It's pretty cool stuff if you're using, you know, the Git or the VS TS service, which used to be called VSO.
As a matter of fact, I was looking at this quite an extensive list already that they have in there in the new updates. And the one that I liked, you know, we talked about Jenkins in the past. That's a nice automation service that's available out in the cloud. And they've introduced now with this team with the latest update, there is a Jenkins queue job, you know, that lets you queue a Jenkins job and monitor it from within TFS build. So. It's nice to see them, you know, working closely with the Jenkins team. That was announced a while back. They were going to try and do a lot more work together, and it's starting to pay some dividends here. Okay, so thanks for all those updates, Kale, and we'll now move to our guest of honor today, Casey Watson. So one of the I kind of alluded to just a little bit earlier that we've the two big, I guess the number one and number two cloud vendors these days are AWS and Azure for the most part. And there's been this thing we've talked about in the past how, you know, companies don't want to put all their eggs into one basket, you know, into one particular cloud vendor. And they want to perhaps this flexibility of being able to have work with different cloud vendors in case one of them has a real bad catastrophe, being able to fail over to another cloud vendor. But doing that is very difficult. And, you know, Casey has some particularly good insight into that. So we'd like to him to explain to us a little bit how that can be done. But before that, Casey, can you please give us an introduction about your background and how you got to working on something like this with this whole multi-platform connectivity thing?
Absolutely. And, you know, first of all, thank you guys for having me on your podcast today. It's always great to, you know, get out there and talk about something that I'm really passionate about. So, as Sujeet mentioned a second ago, I've been doing a lot of work over the last couple of years about building applications that are portable between different cloud providers. So, you know, between AWS and Azure and potentially even other providers in the future. And the way that I got started with this was actually probably about 3 years ago, before I even joined Microsoft. I was working with a company, and they actually do license plate recognition. So their entire job is scanning license plates, looking for cars that need to be picked up or collected for various reasons. And they were wanting to build a new analytics platform, a custom analytics platform on the cloud. And one of the very first things they told me was that, you know, they want to build it on Azure, but they don't want to be locked into Azure. They don't want to be stuck to Azure. And they wanted to figure out how they could build this platform that's going to consist of multiple services in a way where it'd be portable from cloud to cloud, but still take advantage of all the PaaS offerings that Azure has. So it's relatively simple. To create a IaaS-based application or infrastructure-based application on virtual machines and move that from cloud to cloud, but to take advantage of the native platform can be much more difficult because the services are different, they're accessed in different ways. So I was working there. We created an original proof of concept that was internal, and we built a few applications on top of that. And I approached my manager at the time and asked him, you know, just I think a lot of companies have this same kind of problem, this, you know, the same kind of concern and issue, and asked them if we could open source it and actually take the work and open source it. So that was the first version of the platform. It's called Mantle, Mantle version 1. And we used that in production for about 6 months. And then we realized that there were a bunch of different things that were missing. There were things that were missing that we didn't realize when we first started writing it. So then I went back to the drawing board and wrote Mantle V2, which is the framework I'm talking about today, and that's the most current version of that framework.
So Casey, this is Evan. Question
before
we go into kind of the details. So, you know, you were talking about, you know, it is more complicated to use the native PaaS components of the platforms. I mean, at the end of the day, there's, you know, I kind of, typically IaaS VMs are more expensive, right, per computing,
right,
you know, cycle. But there's the kind of the effort piece in there. Were you able to, as you built this, were you able to make it such that, you know, you're not adding a ton of complexity to the design time, so you're not losing all the benefit of being on PaaS?
Yeah, I
assume that was kind of part of it, but...
Yeah, and, you know, sorry if I didn't, you know, highlight that very well, but the idea here is that I built kind of a cloud abstraction framework, right? So if I'm a developer and I've never even heard of the cloud before, let alone AWS or Azure, I can build application logic that uses cloud features, so I can, you know, kind of swap in and swap out those foundational components. So if I want to send a message to a queue somewhere, I really don't have to understand the underlying mechanics of how that works. I just send a message to a iPublisher channel. Or if I want to store a blob or a file somewhere, I don't have to understand how Azure Storage works or AWS S3 works. I just save the file to a iBlob storage client. So the underlying complexities of the cloud platform are basically hidden away from the developer that's using the platform. But it's kind of interesting you bring that up, because one of the things that came up very early on was, even though we have this abstraction on top of the cloud platform, there are still scenarios where you need to gain access to, you know, the actual Azure storage client object or the S3 storage client object. So you can still get access to those, but you have to kind of dig a little bit deep to get access to the object. It's not super obvious that it's there.
Okay. No, that makes perfect sense. I mean, because that's the key, right? Is that when you write the code, you don't have to know or care, so you're not taking this, you know, design time hit, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Because a lot of the services and features that are shared across different cloud platforms are very similar. But it's important to note that not all the features and services are similar. There are certain Azure features that are quote unquote stickier than others. And, you know, we want to drive people to those features, but at the same time, the services that are, you know, somewhat common, and the four key areas that I hit were blob storage, messaging, so sending asynchronous messages back and forth, key value storage, so similar to Redis, and then also cache. Those four services are very common across both platforms.
Now, hey Casey, this is Kale. I just had a couple questions. I hadn't actually, until we had this discussion today, I hadn't even heard of Mantle, but I know there's a couple others that are out there that are trying to do something similar with compute and storage, primarily like libcloud and package cloud and some of these things. And I've played with those before, where they basically, you write to this API that you've built, this SDK, and then you basically in your config file would pass in, I'm using Azure, I'm using Amazon, whatever, or even Google. And so in that case, like, it would take care of that stuff for you. Is this, that's the same with this, right? We would tell it through, like, configuration, which cloud vendor we're using, or whether it's even on-prem or something?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's somewhat similar to that. It's not really API-based, though. So it's .NET-based. And when you create your project, you add the appropriate NuGet packages to your project. So if I was building an application that's going to, you know, process a message queue and, you know, maybe send out emails, I would add a package that includes the worker host, so it would actually host the worker object. and then a package for each one of the providers that I wanted to support, so Azure or AWS. So there are a number of different projects out there, a few of the ones that you mentioned a second ago, and one that's called Cloud Foundry that kind of relies on a non-native platform as a service. But I think this one is different in the sense that it doesn't really expose an API. These are just NuGet packages that you would add to your existing project.
And how do they get invoked in your application in that case if they're just NuGet packages? Like, what's the tie-in to the application itself?
So it relies heavily on inversion and control and dependency injection. So basically what you do is you would add the NuGet packages to your project, and then you would define any number of, they're called mantle profiles. So if you're familiar at all with dependency injection or version of control, you know that a big part of it is binding interfaces to concrete objects. And what I can basically do is say, hey, I have an AWS profile. And as part of the AWS profile, I have a set of bindings here. So if someone asks for a iBlob storage client, that should connect to the AWS blob storage client. And then on the Azure side, if someone asks for an iBlob storage client, it should connect to the Azure blob storage client. So basically that's handled through dependency injection, and depending on which profiles you select, it'll plug in the appropriate concrete classes.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, yep. And so you could still do it like Cale said, right? You could probably do it through configuration and change the actual running, the runtime profile based on some setting.
Right, right. Yeah, and something else that I focused on during recent TechReady talk that I did was, it's one thing to be cloud portable, and you know that's kind of the focus of this project, but it's another thing to be host portable. And what I mean by host portable is, you know, your application is made up of a number of different services. Some of them are web applications, and some of them may be, you know, worker processes that are, you know, running all the time. They could be a web job, or they could be processing a queue, or whatever. And those should be host portable. And by host portable, I mean the application logic that's actually running that worker should be separate from what's hosting it. I should be able to take any one of those worker processes and host it inside of a Windows service or a console application or as part of a Service Fabric service. So that's another really big key component here, is even though it's application level, being able to grab that logic and change how it's actually physically hosted. And Mantle supports different kinds of worker hosts for that.
I see. That's interesting. Yeah. So by requiring that separation, you're able to provide a different host for each of the cloud platforms. Is that what you do?
Yeah, and it goes even further beyond that, because I can take one worker application and I can run it as part of a console application. Then I can take the same worker application and plug it into a Windows service or a Service Fabric service. But the actual application logic itself is not aware necessarily of how it's being hosted, or where it's being hosted. And what that means ultimately is, if there's another platform that I want to plug into it, say, you know, something on-prem using, you know, just NTFS or RabbitMQ or Google Cloud, you know, theoretically you can just build support for that platform and move everything over to that platform without making any changes to your application logic.
You better watch it, Casey. You mentioned Service Fabric, and so she's going to get excited about that.
Yeah. What are you thinking of all sorts of scenarios over here?
Well, you know, what's interesting is the first time I wrote it, I built in support for Azure Cloud Services. So, you know, web roles, worker roles, what we would generally call PaaS V1, right? But the more that, you know, things kind of grew and progressed inside of Azure, I discovered I can take the same model and then build out a Service Fabric worker host, and that's PaaS V2. And something that I mentioned during my talk is that, you know, Service Fabric is the new hotness right now, but I mean, within a few years, there will probably be PaaS V3 and PaaS V4 and PaaS V5, and by building your applications this way, you can essentially future-proof that application logic.
Very, very good. Very good idea.
Oh, that's right, because you wouldn't care. I mean, your app could, you wouldn't have to change your app at all, just deploy it to
exactly
you know, the new hotness at that point.
Yeah.
Casey, one question I had too, I'm kind of curious how you handled it, was specifically with storage. The platforms are different, right? So like Amazon and Azure have different things around, like if you say blob storage, how big blocks can be, how many blocks you can have, how big a single blob can be, all those different like things, and they're totally different between the two platforms. So how do you, is that something you kind of account for, and how does that get handled by the app level in this type of scenario?
The question was around, you know, how do you handle kind of the idiosyncrasies between, you know, AWS S3 and Azure Blob Storage? And the answer is that a lot of that validation logic is baked into the concrete object itself. So I'm only using the iBlob Storage client, but behind the scenes, there is the AWS S3 Blob Storage client or the Azure Blob Storage client that has the validation logic built into that. And one of the interesting things I ran into is that Azure has this concept of a storage account. And, you know, you have a storage account with a maximum size of 500 terabytes. Well, AWS says, you know, we don't have a limit on the amount that you can store. And the reason they don't have a limit on the amount you can store in a single storage account is because AWS doesn't have the concept of a storage account. They have just the top-level buckets, which are similar to Azure containers. So a lot of those complexities are hidden away back inside of the concrete objects themselves. And the configuration system is kind of aware of those differences. And another thing that I spent some time working on was something called auto setup. And that is, you know, let's say that I start writing to a Azure storage container or I start writing to a AWS S3 bucket. The components on the back end, the platform-specific components, will actually look to see, hey, does this container already exist, or hey, does this bucket already exist? And I can configure auto setup to say, if it's not already there, go ahead and create it. And the concept of auto setup is something that's shared across pretty much all those foundational pieces, regardless of what you're trying to abstract away.
Well, you've given this a lot of good thought. Very nice.
So on that auto setup case, I'm just trying to make sure I understand the value. If I understand right, so by kind of auto-creating, that allows you to think at the container level, which is common between the two services, right?
Right.
Is that
kind
of what you're trying to get out of that?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny because, I mean, the idea was really, I hate to say it, was born out of laziness. when we were building, you know, these applications, you know, this is back when we were kind of using Mantle in production, we didn't want to have to go back through and set up all the message queues and set up the blob storage containers and, you know, set up the different, you know, storage tables and whatnot to make everything work. And originally, it would set up everything for you regardless of whether or not you asked it to do so. And obviously that, you know, kind of ran into a problem. So we added the auto setup configuration setting to tell Mantle, you know, basically, if the container is not already there, do you want me to create it or do you want me to just throw an exception? And that's kind of supported across the board. But, yeah, the whole rationale behind that was just that when we were, you know, doing dev and test on this application, we were spending a lot of time doing this kind of mundane setup, and we realized that the framework could handle a lot of that for us.
Okay. No, that makes sense. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I have a couple of questions for you, Casey. First of all, what's the downside? I mean, I know there's some sort of I guess you're taking the least common denominator, right, of all these platforms. That's not terrible. I mean, all these platforms are pretty mature. They have a lot of the features that each other has. But what other downsides are there that you've come across when you've implemented, say, a Mantle application for a customer or something like that?
So the biggest downside, and this is specifically around trying to make a legacy application cloud portable, is that a lot of times, you know, it's hard to go into an application and find all those cloud touch points and, you know, make a clean break there. And that can be really complex to take, you know, even applications that were built in the cloud but are older applications and make them cloud portable. Another, I wouldn't really call it a downside, but, you know, it's just the fact that even though there are some services shared across Azure and AWS that are very common, not all services are. So one of the things that we spent a lot of time trying to figure out in the very beginning was, you know, even though we have this abstraction layer, how do we make it possible where the developer can reach back into it and, you know, actually access the actual Azure Storage Account object? So that was a original downside to the design. And I guess it's really, you know, no secret here that, you know, we all work at Microsoft. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Last time we checked, yeah.
Yeah. I just wasn't sure if that was a something that was secret or not. But anyways, another one of the big downside, kind of as, you know, Microsoft employees is that, you know, obviously we want people to use the Azure platform. And, you know, we want to drive people to build applications on top of Azure. And one of the potential downsides is that we, you know, with Mantle, we are making it easier for customers to move between cloud frameworks. So it's not really a downside for the end user. It's just a, you know, potential downside for us because we are making the platform a little less sticky.
Got it.
Yeah, we'll forgive you for now. You know, although my own personal experience, you know, with that kind of stuff working, because I'm in support, right? So I work directly with customers.
Right.
At the end of the day, most, you know, the I think the really most mature applications that I see are the ones that are leveraging sometimes the best parts of both platforms.
Yeah.
Right. So I think some of what you're doing here is you're saying, you know what, kind of the general stuff that you really, there's not a compelling reason for one or the other. You know, depending on what you're using, right? A lot of times there are, you know, that part you have to be less focused on, right?
Yeah, and a big part of the motivation here is that, you know, if you work at Microsoft and you work in the Azure space, one of the things that you learn early on is that your number one, first and foremost job is a trusted technical advisor. And, you know, I've talked to ISVs and I've talked to GSIs, and they have this question. It's not just that one employer that had the question, but, you know, other companies are curious about how they can build applications that are not dependent on one cloud platform. And as trusted technical advisors, we can't just say, well, don't do that, you know, just stick with Azure. We should be able to turn around and say, well, you know, actually there is a way to do that. And I think by being able to answer that question and being able to, you know, provide a real solution, we build even more trust, you know?
Totally agreed.
I agree. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Well put.
And the second question I had for you was, how'd you come up with the name Mantle?
So I think originally it was just called Cloud Abstraction Framework. And
I don't like that name at all, by the way.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound really cool. And I started thinking about, you know, well, we're providing a lot of this foundation you build your application on top of. And one of the guys I was working with is actually a gamer. And I guess Mantle was like the name of like some super program or group inside of the game he was playing. And so it just kind of stuck. I mean, it just kind of made sense, you know, that your application kind of floats around on top of Mantle. The only bad part behind it is that if you think about the way like the Earth is laid out, there's Mantle, and then your application.
I was thinking about
called,
that. Yeah.
Your application is called Crust, which that's not very.
That's interesting. Okay.
It's also important to point out that all the work I'm doing with Mantle, so all the projects, all the information, it's all open source, so it's all available out there on GitHub today. It's not something that we're working on necessarily internally here at Microsoft. It's something that, you know, I want to share with the larger community.
That's very nice, Casey. That's excellent work. Now, if I may just touch upon one last thing. I know we've kind of belabored this whole discussion quite a bit already, but I want to talk about being able to run both clouds at the same time. Is that something that you see people do? As they say, okay,
yeah.
One's like the primary, and this is kind of like a cold, I don't know, you want to make a cold backup or something like that. Do you see that happening as well?
So I see a lot of companies that have, you know, just really insane RTO and RPO requirements, and, you know, being able to be up and available all the time. And, you know, both platforms have solutions for disaster recovery at a regional level. But there have also been cases. There was actually a case very recently on AWS where there was, you know, a system-wide outage. It happens to both platforms. So for those companies that, you know, want to be 100% available all the time, it might make sense to span multiple clouds. And the idea is, at least from my perspective, is if you're running on AWS today and you have your primary region on AWS and you're not interested in moving over to Azure, maybe it makes sense to take a smaller version of that application and kind of deploy it into warm standby in an Azure region using native Azure PaaS. And then in front of that application, you can use something like Azure Traffic Manager or AWS's Route 53 to automatically route to whichever one of those two regions is currently available. And actually, if you go look at the GitHub repository and the sample application, that's exactly how that's designed. It's designed for active-active replication, and the idea is that you would put that macro-level DNS router on top of that to go to either side. So my hope is, as a Microsoft employee, is that we can talk to GSIs and ISVs that are running on top of AWS and have them consider standing up a minimal version of their application inside of Azure and help drive consumption that way.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. And we did mention replication. Is there any particular techniques that you've used to keep the data in sync between the two platforms?
Absolutely. So whenever you are talking about, you know, either cross-cloud or cross-region replication, you should always, you know, consider, do you want a strong consistency or eventual consistency? And, you know, when you're talking about an application that's potentially running in East U.S. and then a second version of the application that's running in West U.S., eventual consistency makes a lot of sense, because if you're trying to commit data to both regions in a strong way, that's really going to hurt your user experience. And also, if you want to continue to add additional regions, that's going to hurt user experience. So the actual sample application that's available out there on GitHub uses Azure storage queues for AWS to send messages, to send updates over to Azure. And then it uses AWS Simple Queue Service for Azure to send messages back the other direction. So eventual consistency in general is the way to go for these kind of apps.
Excellent. That's good. Well, so that's very nice, Casey. Thanks for that overview on Mantel and some of the good work that you've done with spanning these cloud platforms. Guys, any more questions for Casey?
No, this is great. Thanks, Casey.
Yeah, thanks for joining. This is really cool stuff.
Yeah, I don't think we've had this kind of intense discussion on doing this kind of work. So I'm glad we had Casey on. Well, thanks again for your time, Casey, and Evan and Kale, thanks for all the talking points and discussion.
Thanks, guys.
See everybody next week.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.